Here on FM, our book of the week is the new biography, Benjamin Britten, A Life in the 20th Century, read by Alex Jennings. Today, Paul Kildare explores Britten's final years, when the composer was filled with a new burst of creative energy, culminating in his last opera, Death in Venice. And he puts forward a new and hotly debated theory about the composer's untimely death. First, though, it's 1966, and Britten and Peter Pears contemplate a building project.
For some years, Britten had been worried that the Aubre Festival did not have a venue for large-scale secular works. In the early days, Britten and Pears rounded the corners by paying peppercorn fees, donating their own services, writing the odd cheque. None of this disguised the fact that the economics of the enterprise did not add up. They were hostage to the limited number of seats they could sell for any event, and altogether too much goodwill. What was needed was a hall seating 800 or 1,000 people, which would help balance the books. Away from the centre of the small village of Snape was an old brewer's malt house. Stephen Rice, who had been in charge of the festival since 1955, inspected the sprawling site, which was peppered with Victorian red brick outhouses and a great barn-like structure near the back. The potential acoustic was anyone's guess, though the shoebox shape, brick walls and wooden roof augured well. It all happened remarkably quickly. Funds came from a public appeal and from DECA, the Gulbenkian Trust and the Arts Council, and construction began. By the beginning of May, the building was almost done. In a touching photograph, Britten, Pears and the engineer Sugden look on as one of the carpenters plays his violin in the hall. He is seated on a stool on the malting stage, hair brushed back, looking to the world like a member of the Amadeus Quartet. Only his apron and bag of tools give him away. The brickwork and roof are visible, and most of the seats in place. Britten is rapt by the performance, his mind racing, while Pears and Sugden have huge smiles on their faces. The hall's glorious acoustic, glossy yet precise, was casting its spell for the first time. The opening on the 2nd of June 1967 was a formal affair. The Queen and Prince Philip lunched with Britten, Pears, and some appropriately titled guests at the Red House. They then drove to Snape. The audience stood for the national anthem in Britten's arrangement, which starts as a hushed prayer before exploding in riotous jubilation in the second verse. Two years later, catastrophe. The concert hall burnt down on the opening day of the 1969 festival. Britten took it calmly. Not for a minute did he think the hall would not be rebuilt.
"Exactly as it was?" inquired the engineer.
"Oh yes, exactly," responded Britten.
And then they got on with the festival.
"I have been longing for ages to make an opera out of Death in Venice, and I want to go ahead with it rather quickly,"
Britten wrote to Thomas Mann's son, Golo, in 1970. At the same time, he asked Mvamwy Piper if she would undertake the libretto. When asked about the sense of urgency, Britten replied,
"It is probably Peter's last major operatic part."
With a second draft of the Death in Venice scenario in his hand, Britten decamped to Venice in October, Pears and John and Mvamwy Piper at his side. They looked at the city almost with fresh eyes, determined not to miss anything they might appropriate for the opera. They tracked down a gondolier who knew the traditional cries, and in a notebook Britten wrote out the strange animal calls as the Venetian made them, Pears jotting down the words. He noted down the bells of St. Mark's, incorporating them into the opera's delayed overture, a sonic picture of the city, in which bells clang away, their ripe overtones written into the score.
Home from Venice, Britten found himself out of sorts. Everything seemed to take more effort. He had trouble climbing stairs, and in August 1972 was diagnosed with aortic incompetence, a condition where blood leaks through the valve, causing the heart to work overtime. He needed to undergo surgery to replace the leaky valve sooner rather than later. Britten was usually good with his doctors, but not this time. Death in Venice took priority over surgery.
"Ben is writing an evil opera, and it's killing him," Piers complained.
This was now his late period. The recognition that he was very ill injected his work with greater urgency and intensity. Britten and Piper came up with some smart narrative innovations, turning Mann's lightly sketched hotel manager into seven distinct characters, each of whom is the figure of death in disguise. The beautiful Taggio is mute in Mann. Here they made him a dancer. There is the arresting dream sequence. Men and women dressed in furs, horns on their heads, gripping torches or daggers, beating cymbals and drums, howling like dogs. It is one of Britten's great moments of release. The orchestral texture is thick and ecstatic. The percussion clanks like a large gamelan ensemble, and the writer awakes, muttering the same noises himself. Ravaged, his demise now inevitable. While Mann's Aschenbach was writing arid work, lacking in joy and distinction, Britten, at this late stage, had produced a work of searing brilliance and originality, his powers undiminished. Britten kept his promise to his doctor. On the 7th of May, he had surgery at the National Heart Hospital. It took 6 hours and was hugely problematic. When the surgeon cut open Britten's chest and began working on the enlarged heart, he discovered the aorta was riddled with tertiary syphilis. It seems likely that as he sweated and hallucinated through his illness in 1940, his body was reacting not to streptococcal tonsillitis, but to syphilis in its secondary stage. In 1940, he would still have had 3 to 5 years in which the brand new drug penicillin would cure him, but by 1960, and certainly by 1973, the damage was done. Nothing was said publicly. The surgeon barely said anything during the operation. Further surgery was useless. Over time, the surgeon felt the burden of his discovery and the decisions he made in an instant about disclosure. 10 years or so after Britten's death, he confided in a close friend and cardiologist. Recovery was desperately slow. Photographs from 1974 show two different Brittens. The first, an enfeebled, droopy-eyed, wild-haired old man. The second, a glint-eyed, ferocious musician looking at scores. In November 1975, Britten visited Venice for the last time, and it was here, with all the sounds and smells around him, that he completed the String Quartet No. 3. It is a work of great calm and resolve, and in its gently lapping rhythms, its musical quotations from Death in Venice and the clanging city itself, the quartet acts as an unexpected coda to the opera.
"I want the work to end with a question," Britten said of the quartet.
But in everything else in his life, he was tying up loose ends. The biggest piece of unfinished business was Paul Bunyan. Since Auden's death, he had picked and prodded at the operetta they had worked on in America, bringing it closer to the work he wished he had written, and he was struck by how strong he found it. But the 1976 broadcast shattered him, especially the opening to the final litany. The campfire embers are black and cold. The banjos are broken. The stories are told. The woods are cut down, and the young are grown old. He broke down crying, this young man grown old, and was comforted by peers, Auden a heavy, unacknowledged presence in the room. On the 4th of December, Britain's breathing deteriorated in the early hours of the morning. His nurse, Rita Thompson, entered the room at 4:15 a.m., arriving just in time to watch Britain die in Piers's arms. The funeral was held on the 7th of December. The choir sang the 16-year-old Britain's A Hymn to the Virgin, his simple yet affecting anthem, so sure in its faith and musical vision. My dearest darling, Piers had written 2 years earlier from New York, in response to an outpouring of love and emotion from Britain. You say things which turn my heart over with love and pride. But you know, love is blind. And what your dear eyes do not see is that it is you who have given me everything right from the beginning, from yourself in Grand Rapids, through Grimes and Serenade and Michelangelo and Canticles, one thing after another, right up to this great Aschenbach. I am here as your mouthpiece, and I live in your music. And I can never be thankful enough to you and to fate for all the heavenly joy we have had together for 35 years. Piers went on almost as before, determined to prove he was his own man. He often spoke about what Britain had given him, the great roles from Grimes to Aschenbach. Even beyond the works themselves, though, Britain's gift was to change the way music is thought about and presented in his country of birth, shifting it far closer to the continental model of training and performance he admired in his youth and thought lacking in more slapdash Britain. All of us, the public, critics and composers themselves, spend far too much time worrying about whether a work is a shattering masterpiece, Britain said 10 years before his death. Let us not be so self-conscious. Maybe in 30 years' time, very few works that are well known today will still be played. But does that matter so much? Surely, out of the works that are written, some good will come, even if it is not now. And these will lead on to people who are better than ourselves. Much good did come from the revolution he precipitated. But he will be astounded to see how many of his works are played today. He was the 20th century's consummate musician. But he was also the spoilt child Forster once identified, who stamped his foot until he got his way. In so doing, he produced a body of works and performances that was unrivaled in the 20th century and is unlikely to be surpassed anytime soon.
Alex Jennings was reading from Benjamin Britten, A Life in the 20th Century by Paul Kildare. And you can listen to an interview with the author on the Radio 4 website. The abridger was Richard Hamilton and the producer was Elizabeth Allard. Next week, BBC Radio 4 remembers James Bulger. Winifred Robinson returns to speak to Ralph Bulger, James' father, 20 years after the murder of his much-loved son.
Sometimes I was drinking like a bottle of whiskey. I couldn't even get drunk. So I'd go on to like 2 bottles of whiskey a day. Wake up. Fall asleep, wake up. Start again. Wouldn't eat. And just go back on the drink. Just to try and kill the pain.
Remembering James Bulger is on Tuesday morning at 9 and again in the evening at 9:30.